Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Jerry.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied.
And now, here are your hosts, Aaron Dicer and Jeremy Scott.
Buoyant.
Hell, they could let anybody in here. Well, what if I'm a Russian?
Be a buoyant Russian.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Recotopia episode 85. I'm Jeremy Scott.
And I'm Dicer.
And I would like to, he's dropping his first name. And I would like to say a special welcome to our friends in the chat who are with us live as we record this and make mistakes. We will edit out later for the rest of you to never hear. Episode 85 reminds me of the Seinfeld episode where Elaine took the IQ test on behalf of George, but because she was so distracted, she scored poorly. And you're in Jerry's apartment with her and Jerry, and he looks out the window and sees George, and he's like, "How'd you do, George?" And you just hear George's voice go, "85, Jerry." Anyway, this week's big recommend is The Hoax, starring Richard Gere and Alfred Molina. But before we get there, we like to do some small recommends. Aaron, have you brought any small recommends this week for the gang?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I have. We'll talk a current movie and an older movie. We'll start with the current movie. I wanted to talk a little bit about Bottoms as a small recommend. This is a ton of fun. It comes to us from the same director. I think Seligman is her last name, and she directed Rachel Sennott in Shiva Baby. So now she's directing this. Of course, Rachel's in this as well as Io from The Bear, who you may know from The Bear, and many, many others. And this is a teen comedy that kind of harkens back to like a Heathers style teen comedy where it's very satirical, very over the top. This is a tone that is really difficult to get right, especially in this era, in this generation. Satire is hard to do because it feels so false. It feels so fake. Like, this isn't a real world. Nobody in this movie is existing in a real world. So when you want to turn that into a real message or a real emotion, it can become very difficult. But I think this movie manages to do it pretty well. Lots of laughs here, lots of over-the-top high school-type comedy. Jeremy, I think you're really going to dig this
when you get around to seeing it. One that I'm going to get to here in the next month or so, and I keep hearing that Marshawn Lynch has a scene-stealing turn as a gym teacher or coach or something.
He's a teacher who ends up sponsoring their club. And, you know, I think athletes sometimes get graded on a different scale than other actors, right? When LeBron James is in something, it's like, yeah, LeBron's pretty good, you know? Yeah. Like, and so there is a little bit of that. But no, he actually holds his own on a comedy level with everybody and what they're doing in here. So, yeah, I thought Marshawn was fine in this. I thought he was good.
Excellent. My first small recommend this week is also a movie. It's brand new. I believe Friday is when it came out. It's a Hulu original called No One Will Save You, and it stars, why did I just lose her name? Caitlin Dever. This is from the guy who made Spontaneous, which I big recommended on this show a year or more ago, and I have raved about several times. That movie bends genres. This movie does the same. Basically, Caitlin Dever plays a girl named Brynn who is a hermit. She dances around to old-timey music on records, happily picks up and hangs up the phone whenever it rings. It's clear that she's intentionally cut herself off from the world, and throughout the movie, we'll get some bits of information as to why. This movie has almost zero dialogue. Arguably, there's one line that the main character says. There are moments where she sort of half mutters, exclaims something like an oh or gah or what. And so maybe it's cheating to say this movie only has one line of dialogue. There's a couple of background characters that speak. But for the most part, she's carrying this movie on physical acting and facial acting, and she's every bit as good as she has ever been. This movie is funny. This movie is scary. This movie is gross. It's kind of an alien invasion, home invasion thing that about 20 minutes in ends where most alien invasion movies would end. Like a thing happens and you're like, oh, it's a 20-minute movie and the credits are going to roll. But then it just keeps going. And it's very clever in that regard. And then it has an ending that delighted me. I can't recommend this enough if you like Caitlin Dever or twisty fun horror romp thrillers. It's on Hulu. Fly, you fools. Very high on my list.
I checked this out last night. I think Caitlin Dever is amazing in this movie. I think, to be honest, I believe she's the reason this works, because this is very gimmicky. Like once you lock into what they're doing here, it could very easily become, I think somebody would be talking here during this. You know what I like? It very easily you can slip into, I see what you're doing. It reminds me of, the screen movies where everything's on a screen. And sometimes it's like, I see how you had to force that to be on the computer screen. Or, when you're doing the found footage and it's like, would somebody really have a camera right there? You know, you're trying to stick to the gimmick. And there is a little bit of that here. But she saves it. I think she's really incredible in this. And worth watching just for her performance alone, if nothing else.
I don't think I've ever seen her be anything but great. In everything she's been in. Booksmart, she does the comedy well. She did that show on Netflix about assault. Unbelievable. She's amazing in that.
She was good in the Tim Allen show. She rises above
that a fair bit. And it's obvious that other than Tim Allen, like, she's the only other real talent on that show.
I will not stand for this Nancy Travis erasure.
Is just playing Tim Allen's wife. She has been great in the past, but it's clear that this girl was acting circles around the other siblings on that show.
No, I agree. I actually, 1 year when we went to LA, went to a taping of that show, a live taping of that show.
Oh, wow.
And saw her act circles around everybody.
How long does a taping of a half-hour sitcom last?
That one lasted about 3 hours, and they passed around pizza at about the 2 hour.
I was going to say, mark. They feed you, right?
Yeah. Just cheese pizza, like the worst.
Have you ever gone back and watched that episode to try and hear your own laugh? Because that
Because I wasn't playing that game. Like, so I wasn't laughing. It's so hard for me because, you know, they're like, all right, guys, like, laugh it up. You know, it's like, how about you just show us the comedy? And if we laugh, we laugh. And so, like, I'm purposefully just like, I don't know. When people tell me to laugh, I'm just like, I don't know. Then I feel like I'm serving their, you know, capitalistic purposes and not my own sense of humor.
I agree with there is if I'm ever at a thing where somebody holds up an applause sign, I am not clapping.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I get it. I understand what you're doing. Part of what you're producing is the audience reaction at a live show. But I want you to be confident enough in your material that you just let the audience react, you know? But that's just not how it works. So, yeah.
Do you have a second small recommend this week, sir?
I do. It is an older film. I finally got around to seeing A Bronx Tale, which is De Niro's directorial debut, based on a Chaz Palminteri one-man show that he did for a long time. And De Niro also acts in it. And they basically play kind of the two father figures to this young man who is growing up in the Bronx during, I believe, the 60s, if I remember that correctly, maybe like late 50s, early 60s, somewhere in that range. And kind of how he deals with that, how he deals with growing up in that era and being in especially the, you know, the racially charged part of that. There's an interracial relationship that plays into what's going on here. Lots of narration. It's very Goodfellas. You can really tell that De Niro was paying attention when Scorsese was directing him in Goodfellas. There's lots of needle drops, lots of narration. The difference is, in my opinion, and I'm not saying there's no heart in Marty Scorsese movies. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there's a real interesting heart here about what it means to be loved versus what it means to be feared, and which is more powerful, which is more important. And I don't know that the movie gives any easy answers on that question. It really kind of shows you that both things have results, consequences, both negative and positive. So I don't know. It's a little over the top at a couple points, but I really, really liked A Bronx Tale. I'd say I loved A Bronx Tale. I thought it was great. So I'm really glad I watched it and I liked what it had to say. And, you know, found it a little breezier, a little more accessible than some of the gangster stuff that that Scorsese and others have done. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I saw it once. Probably right when it hit video after being in the theaters, maybe a year after. And I don't remember anything about it. So it's one of those I need to go back to. And I'm also wondering what happened to Chaz Palminteri, because for the 90s, it seemed like he was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I just don't see him anymore. I Googled, he's still alive.
Yeah, he's still around.
Hard breaking news on Wreckatopia regarding the living and death status of actors from gangster movies.
I believe we can say now, just breaking, Chaz Palminteri is still alive.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Now, I will tell you this. If somehow he dies.
Oh, no. Don't.
This next week.
Before the episode comes out.
I will be beside myself. My second small recommend to keep things super serious is a soft drink. Ha! not long ago, I brought you the Tropical Sprite and the Cherry Sprite that they had rolled out. And not to be outdone, 7-Up has released this Tropical 7-Up that, from what I can tell, is exclusive to Kroger stores. And I would imagine that's all of the owned by Kroger stores like Fred Meyer and Ralph's and all that stuff. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, this is one of my favorite soft drinks I've ever had. I'm on my fourth bottle. I don't drink soft drinks much at all. I have like a half of a 20-ounce bottle every other day. I've cut it mostly out of my life. But so over the last 2-3 weeks, I've had like 4 or 5 bottles of this stuff. Good.
I thought you were going to say I'm on my fourth bottle of the day. It's 11:30.
I just, I mean, now back in my movie theater management days when I could go down to the concession and fill my 32-ounce cup with Mountain Dew. Oh, I was drinking so much soft drinks. It was not good. But anyway, go get thee to a Kroger or Kroger-owned superstore near you and try a Tropical 7-Up because I believe you will not regret it. So there you go.
Very nice.
Looks also, yummy. Yes, Slab is correct in the chat that somebody needs to make a list of all the food and beverage recommends on the show. Because it's probably 50% soft drinks at this point, which is wild. All right, it's time for this week's big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Going back to 2006 with Richard Gere and Alfred Molina and Lasse Hallström as the director and The Hoax. This is based on a true story. Clifford Irving is a real person who really did try and pull this off, and then turned it into a memoir called The Hoax. And he was on set as a consultant until he disliked what he saw enough to ask his name to be removed from the film. So take that for what it's worth. The movie opens near the end, needlessly. We'll get to that when we get to that. But the true open of the movie is Clifford Irving trying to sell his second book. He's in a meeting with some publisher representatives, and they're telling him, your last book was good, but it didn't sell very well. But we're really excited about this new book. It's going to be awesome. And then we have this woman who named Andrea, who I thought was his agent for a time, but then it's clear she works at the publishing office. So maybe she's the woman who signs him or signed him. But she's telling him all this foolish stuff, like they're going to put so many units behind this book. They're going to throw so much money at it. This is a sure thing. But what does Clifford Irving do? He goes out and starts spending money. If there's one thing the movies have taught me, it's to never go out and spend money until you actually have the money to afford those things. So he buys a new car. And he plans.
That's, by the way, that's just called economics.
So we get a brief interaction with his wife where we hear her say something, and he assures her it's over with her. So we know that he has in the past had some sort of affair. But that night he goes to a mixer cocktail party. Not sure entirely. And that's where he's slapped in the face by Andrea with the news that they're not publishing his book. Somebody at Life magazine read it and hated it. And the book publisher really respects that guy's opinion, and it has snowballed, and now you're screwed. He had already planned this boy's getaway with his friend Dick, that's Alfred Molina, down to Nassau, I think. And so they decide to go, and there's a scene on the plane that I think is really important, but it's kind of a throwaway scene where Clifford asks Dick about his new book, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'm writing about, I forget whether King Richard or something. He's like, hey, I really want to keep it authentic, but what do you do about the sodomy? Clifford says, I'm sure it'll be great. You're an excellent researcher and a fine writer. And I feel like that's maybe one of the worst backhand compliments I've ever seen in film. Like, to say you're a superior researcher, but you're down here as a writer. But the word fine right. is still implied to be a compliment. And I just think it speaks to the mindset of Clifford and how much he loves himself and his own thoughts and ideas and work, and how he sees everybody else around him. Anyway, I think that's kind of an important character note. Then at 1 a.m, they get kicked out of the resort, as all of the residents do, because Howard Hughes, famous billionaire, aviator, filmmaker, germaphobe, has decided he wants the entire hotel to himself, and Clifford notes that's power. But they're still kind of put out. He goes back to his publisher. He's going to pitch a new book, but before he can pitch a new book, he is pawned off on a young intern looking girl assistant instead of Andrea, and he's instantly annoyed that he has been demoted as a writer, and he storms into the conference room and says, I'm writing the greatest book of the 20th century. You meet me tomorrow morning at a bowling alley at 9:30, and you get the pitch. Simon and Schuster will be there. And he storms out, and I think it speaks to his charisma that works. And so Andrea shows up the next day, and thankfully by then Clifford has been inspired by a magazine cover of Howard Hughes to write the great American biography on Howard Hughes. He has actually trained himself overnight to forge Howard Hughes' writing style in a way that will pass more than one handwriting test. And I gather that some measure of that must have actually happened.
No, I researched that part specifically, and to me it is the most amazing part. A handwriting expert said if it were a forgery, it'd be a 1 in a million. They gave it a 1 in a million chance of being a forgery. And so, yeah, he somehow fooled them.
That's crazy. So his story, his idea, as he explains to Dick, is this guy is a hermit. No one ever sees him. No one speaks to him directly. He does hand pass notes to even his top closest advisors. He's also got this lawsuit going on that's going to cost him hundreds of millions of dollars. He's not going to say anything, and no one can prove we didn't talk to him. I'll come up with the story, bumped into him at that resort when we were getting kicked out, hit it off, sent him my book. He loved it, and we started talking more and more, and the idea of this autobiography came up. And so he starts reading everything he can about the man, and they go to D.C., and start researching him. They start photographing government documents in the Congressional Library, which is illegal. They even steal documents from the Pentagon, which is wild. Then they go to Vegas, and they meet with this guy, Noah Dietrich, who was one of Hugh's right-hand men, and they're expecting him to be really cagey and not give them any information. It's the opposite. He's like, come on in. Do you want some tea? Here's this manuscript I wrote about my time with Howard Hughes. And they're like, oh, well, great. This is great. Thank you. And he's like, oh, you can't take it. You have to read it right now and then tell me if you want to work with me on a book. I'm going to go get in the pool. That's what old people do. So he sends Dick out surreptitiously to photocopy the entire manuscript, stealing. And then they go in and tell him, oh, this is no good. It's unpublishable. I'm sorry. And I think it's worth noting that at almost every point where there is a risk that needs to be taken, he makes Dick do it. He doesn't do it himself. And again, I think this speaks to his self-love and narcissism. And there's an act he will do later that we'll get to that really spells that all out. So they get called to the publisher's office because Life magazine has some suspicions about their book. And here's an interesting scene because Dick spouts off before they can even get in. Nobody's even sitting down yet. Dick is like, he gave me a prune.
It's the funniest thing in the movie to me.
It's hysterical. He gave me a prune.
He's
and
so
Cliff,
good in that scene.
He's good in the whole movie. I think he's the secret star of the movie. But this is where we get an amazing scene of Clifford's incredible storytelling abilities that get them off the hook. He makes up on the spot this absolutely believable, riveting story about how they met Hughes that ends with him offering Dick a prune. And having done just a wee bit of improv in college, it's really hard to do that well. His charisma is what skates him by. He actually says at one point, go in the room, tell them the most audacious thing ever, and because it's what they want to hear, they'll give you $500,000. Anyway, I love that scene. Dick moves into the guest house at Cliff's home. We get some more scenes with Cliff and his wife. I think it's interesting to point out that all of his wife's paintings in this movie are the real Edith's paintings, his now ex-wife. Well, I'm not sure she's alive anymore. When they made the movie, Clifford Irving, the real man, thought it would be, you know, the right thing to do to have her paintings licensed and used as her paintings. I thought that was an interesting detail of, I guess, reality. Mm-hmm. Clifford does go to a bar with Dick. And then he stays and Dick goes home and he stupidly goes and has an affair again with this former flame and regrets it immediately. So do we. Then they start listening to tapes of Hughes's testimony before Congress, and Cliff playfully imitates his voice and has kind of a fun knack for picking it up. And then this is where we get my favorite scene in the entire movie, where they start to do an interview between Dick and Hughes, and Clifford is doing Hughes's voice. And the very first question is about his father, and Clifford just gets lost in playing the character of Hughes and becomes Hughes, at least to he and Dick in the moment. And again, I think it speaks to his abilities. He's a bad person, at least as this movie portrays, but he's talented at the stuff that can help you skate by. Anyway, I love that. At the end of that scene, Dick says, Jesus, Cliff. And that's it. And I think that's where we see that both the pinnacle of his talent, but also the moment where he like maybe completely loses himself in this campaign. But now, well, wait a minute. There's news of another Hughes book at another publisher and excerpts in another magazine, and the publisher is furious. So, again, Cliff sends Dick down to Nassau to have another forged letter sent to the publisher from Howard Hughes. And Cliff goes in to the publisher's meeting on the offensive. And this is a true gamble. He has demanded that the CEO of the owning company be there. This is Stanley Tucci. And if this gambit doesn't work, he's done. But it works because he goes on the defensive. He starts telling the publishing executive, I don't like your tone. Don't talk to me in that tone anymore. You over there, CEO guy, there's a letter. Have you gotten your mail yet? Go get your mail. And so it's a rambling rant about how much Hughes hates the CEO of Life magazine. And basically, Cliff demands, and Howard demands, Howard quotes in a letter, $1 million, or we're taking it to another publisher, despite the fact that we have a contract. And again, Cliff just hits the gas in terms of being on the offensive and walks out of the room. And of course, it works. And this may actually be Cliff's best performance because I think he fully, he even says, I am Howard Hughes. And I think he believes it a little bit, even though he doesn't, that's not what he means literally by saying this, the sentence. He's saying, I'm speaking for him right now. Anyway, love that scene. So just like that, they cut a check for $1 million. And there's one problem. They make it out to Howard Hughes. So how do Cliff and Dick cash or deposit a check made out to Howard Hughes? And then this is where Cliff's wife, Lady Macbeth herself, into the picture and comes up with this idea to have the check remade out to his initials, H.R. Hughes, and then create a fictional woman who can go to Switzerland and open up a Swiss bank account with her fake ID and her for H.R. Hughes and deposit the check. This is ultimately what does them in. And I feel like they should have known that, but they, I think, were pretty desperate at this point because otherwise they weren't going to get any money. Before she leaves on her trip, though, she finds a letter to Cliff and opens it, which is not cool. Don't do that, spouses. But it's from Nina, the mistress, and this is where she realizes that he's cheated on her again. While she's in Switzerland, Clifford receives a box of really interesting documents that suggest Howard Hughes gave money to Nixon's brother and all sorts of other political influence, bribery type stuff. And he believes this box has been sent to him by Howard Hughes himself because he believes Howard wants us to take down Nixon. And I just think it's fascinating how quick something can spiral out of control once you start believing your own lie. They're called to the publisher's office because Howard Hughes has contacted them. And he plans to call at 1 o'clock. And he's going to talk with a journalist that has interviewed him extensively in the past and would know whether or not it's the real Howard Hughes. Cliff is so nervous, he leaves the room, tries to flee, and ends up in a fire stairwell and finds Dick, who's also trying to flee, but there's no exit. So Clifford has to go back up and says, what happened? And they're like, no, and he sent us out of the room. And eventually the journalist comes out and says, that was 100% Howard Hughes. And he says, you are a fraud. He's never met you or talked to you. Hang on, lost my place in my notes. Clifford starts. What appears to be, I love this shot, what appears to be an admission of guilt. I have led you astray. I've lied to you. And as the camera pans around to the front of his face, we realize this is just his thoughts. He hasn't actually spoken yet. So he is not going to admit that he's guilty. And he instead spins another story about having dirt on Hughes because he thought this might happen. And they basically give him 2 days to produce the manuscript and Howard Hughes. So Cliff goes and finds Dick drunk at a bar with two girls and sees an evil opportunity to ensure Dick's loyalty in this scheme and basically pays one of the girls to go home with Dick and sleep with him. And Dick has been shown to be a man that really loves his wife and has not until now been unfaithful. And this is cruelty through and through. And Dick has done nothing to deserve it. All right, so the day of Howard Hughes' arrival comes. Clifford shows up, gives two manuscripts, one to the journalist dude from before and one to the head publishing guy. They apparently read this 1,000-page document in what looks like a couple of hours. I don't know how they did that, but good for them. Maybe you can speed read when you get to that level of publishing. Meanwhile, Howard has a huge list of specific instructions, or he will not arrive. They had to tear up the carpet in the top floor floors and evacuate the top four floors and make a northwest, east, south grid on the roof with white powder paint. It's all these specific things, which is just Cliff's genius plan, because he has rigged it so that one little detail, east and west being reversed on the roof, causes the helicopter to approach and then leave. This might be bad, except when he gets downstairs, the exec and the journalist freaking loved the manuscript. They call it a masterpiece. So again, the truth or questions about it are shoved to the side. But the media keeps up the pressure, and then Edith calls from Europe and says she thinks she's being watched. Probably is. She's committing a huge crime over there. But then Cliff is kidnapped and taken to a hotel, probably Florida, Nassau, I don't really even know. And he's brought before Howard Hughes' right-hand man. He's too bold and cocky, saying he deserves to meet Howard. So they throw him off the roof of the balcony into the pool below and then pick him up in a car. And basically, this guy confirms Mr. Hughes wants that Nixon information in the book. So he goes to the publisher, begging for the Nixon information to be put in the book, but overhears a call coming in from the Zurich District Attorney's Office and realizes his wife has been detected in Switzerland and takes off hightailing it. But the media is waiting for him at home. His wife returns and gives him one chance to come clean about the affair, one chance to finally be honest instead of always lying, and he tells a partial truth that he then spins into a lie of him denying Nina and telling her no, and his wife seems to believe him, and it's kind of disturbing because that, again, speaks to how far he can get manipulating people just with his natural acting and improv ability.
It also speaks to human nature, which I think is a really interesting thing as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Before we're done, Dick finds out that Cliff paid for the girl to sleep with him and goes to confront her. I meant to point this out. When Dick finds out the next morning after cheating and breaks down over what he's done, it's one of the most powerful scenes I've seen in a long while because it just rings extremely true. But now he's mad. Cliff begins ranting and telling the story about being kidnapped and meeting with Hughes, and Dick says it's all in his head. Dick saw Cliff that night inside the house, drunk and rambling. Goodness gracious, none of that happened. Which you, I guess you kind of suspect when it's happening. The way it's shot is sort of dreamlike, what have you. But then Hughes finally goes public and outs Cliff as a fraud, all while Cliff is at a fancy party and it's on TV and he's humiliated publicly. So he gets arrested and we learn that he takes a higher sentence so that his wife and Dick can take a lower sentence. He has one more hallucinated conversation with this right-hand man of Howard Hughes, where he imagines the whole ordeal, everything, was orchestrated by Howard, and that they wrote the book at Howard's direction, only to have Howard use it as a poker chip for his own gain. And then there's a moment at the end of this movie that I will outright tell you I hate, where Dick goes walking through New York City, hugest city in America, and just happens by a store where Dick has now written and published his book and he's doing a signing and they exchange glances and then Dick walks away. And I really, what the shit? and that's the end of the movie. Aaron, I believe this was your first time seeing the hoax. Okay, to give us your thoughts.
What an incredible story. I am an absolute sucker for true stories. And I understand Hollywood has a history of changing them, adapting them. This is no different. Lots of adaptations to the true story from the fact that Clifford spent months planning this, didn't just have it on a spur of a moment. This was a deliberate plan, not a like spur of the moment idea. The fact that Dick was much more involved and not like a patsy, like the movie makes him out to be. They were really co-conspirators and all that kind of stuff. And I get why you do those things, right? We need Dick to show us the better version of Clifford. We need somebody who we feel sorry for this terrible, you know, how this terrible man, and is another example of how he is just using everybody in his path. But I'm a sucker for a true story. This is a really fascinating one and goes along the lines of, and I won't be using this for my super secret double feature, but it is a fairly obvious choice. It's that catch me if you can thing, right? Like where it's just like, if you're confident enough about something,
yeah,
and you've done the least bit of homework on, you know, whatever you're doing, people will believe anything because we just go through our lives expecting that everybody approaches things like we do, which yeah. is I'm who I am. I'm not pretending. I mean, I guess you could have an interesting deep conversation about how we're all performing on some level or another, but not usually in these big ways of today I'm going to be an airline pilot, even though I've never taken a single class in what it means to be a pilot, you know? And much like that movie, we also have the aspect here of this man doing this terrible thing, treating people terribly, trying to get away with it. And what does he get? Some time in prison, and now he gets to make money off of it. Now yeah. he gets to tell his story and sell it as a book and sell it as a movie yep. and get rich off of. And I'm just like, our society has to stop rewarding behavior because we want to be entertained by it. I don't know how to fix that. But yeah, it's one of those things that it's like the cognitive dissonance kind of comes in to the true yeah. story part of it. So I love the true story aspect of everything that's going on here. Speaking of that, in some of the research, it was interesting to see like some of the things he told the movie people also weren't true. Like that whole helicopter thing never happened, but he told the movie people it did and wanted it in the movie and that kind of thing. So it's not like this person has necessarily changed their ways either. So, that was interesting.
Well, even Catch Me If You Can, your example of mm-hmm. early comparison has, you know, since been shown to be that he basically made all that up. He didn't do most of what that movie's, because the only source was him. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah.
Yeah. I have several scenes in this that I really, really liked. You mentioned all of them, I think, actually. The scene where he does the false confession, where you think he's confessing and it pans around and he's not saying anything. I don't know that I've ever really seen that before. And that's interesting because it works really, really well.
Yeah.
And is a nice little, trick on the audience. And I think it does what it's supposed to do. It lets us live in a world where he's an actual human being for a second and then takes it away from us and goes, no, not this guy.
Yep. Yeah. And like you said, maybe it's arguable that he hasn't really even learned anything from this whole
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. The other one you mentioned was you're exhausted from the lies. So go ahead and tell me the truth. This is your moment to be clean. And he does something that the best liars know to do, which is to tell a half truth. Mm-hmm. He does that thing where it's like, yes, I met with her. Yes, you know, I shouldn't have done it. I was attracted to her or whatever. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And because the human nature thing, when somebody is talking to you and they're willing to go, yeah, I screwed up. Yeah, but this didn't happen. Like, there's something about wanting to grab hold of that and to offer grace and forgiveness or whatever. And it's a really fascinating look into how people can be deceived so easily and how easy it is to deceive people.
Well, and the whole movie arguably is trying to point out, you know, if people want to believe something, it's so much easier to convince them that it's true. The publishers all want Howard Hughes book. Like, they're like, this is going to sell more copies than the Bible. They all want this to be true. And that helps sell his lie. Sorry, you were going to say something.
No, I think that's it, right? And there's even a scene where they are presenting the book for the first time. I don't remember if you mentioned this or not, but they're presenting the book for the first time, and the guy is saying something along the lines of, We love this book. It's so clearly a look into Howard Hughes's mind. If you were to fake this, you'd have to be Shakespeare, and we know Clifford isn't Shakespeare.
Right, exactly.
You know, like that kind of thing. And that's just such a beautiful look at, like, the way you can dismiss something, you know, it's just, I found that really fascinating and interesting. Richard Gere has said this is his most underrated film. I thought that was an interesting thing. He said that in an interview one time, that he feels like this is his most underrated film.
He's really good. He's really good in this.
And so, yeah, I would agree. I think he is really good in this. There's a heisty element to this movie that I like as well, especially from the beginning. And that's where I have to be careful with like my own like rooting interests and stuff, because there's something about pulling a con that I find captivating and intoxicating, right? And so the idea of we're going to read this document in front of you while you're swimming in the pool, and he's handing it, you know, surreptitiously to Dick, and Dick's running out and actually making a copy and then coming back, and he's like, okay, we're done, we read the whole thing and it's terrible. Like, that whole thing is really fun. And so then I'm like, yeah, but no, it shouldn't be fun. It should be terrible. That's terrible. They're doing terrible things. So then I have that cognitive dissonance thing that goes off with me as well. So, but yeah, no, I had a good time. I think The Hoax is a really good flick.
I think, I mean, even at the end of the movie, I believe it says that he's still trying to get his autobiography of Hughes published.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
Completely made up. Now, would I read the shit out of that? Yes, I would, because I have seen and enjoyed this movie. But just, yeah, just, oh, still, let's still publish this thing I'm famous for faking. That just is wild to me.
It is wild.
A few more notes. That Time magazine cover in his jail cell is altered to look like Richard Gere, but that's real. He was really on the cover of Time magazine. So again, something he probably saw as a reward, something that probably spurred him to write the book that led to this movie. So yeah, as a society, we've got to stop rewarding people for doing terrible things just because, like you said, it's entertaining to us. The movie says, it starts with the helicopter scene. I don't think movie gains much from doing this in the middle, in medias res thing or whatever, but I don't hate it. But then it says 4 months earlier. And I would just like the people who made this movie to know how hard it would be to write any book in less than 4 months, let alone one as large and detailed that they'd have to do all this research for. I've written a few books. It's not as easy as this movie makes it seem. So when you talk about the fact that he didn't just come up with the idea overnight, but was something he planned for months, I'm thinking the writing of the book also lasted longer in real life.
Oh, I'm sure it did, yeah.
Let's see. History, from what I can gather, does sort of suggest that this book and Howard denouncing it and the whole hoax probably did lead Nixon, as the movie suggests, to authorize the break-in at the Watergate Hotel to find out what else.
Mm-hmm.
What other dirt do they know about me? And yeah, I like the backdrop of the war protests here and there, because I feel like the real good humans were either over there fighting or protesting that war on behalf of the soldiers. And here's this guy trying to get rich, telling a fake story by conning everybody. I just think it's a nice dichotomy there to look at. All right, that's all of my notes. I hope you guys enjoyed The Hoax, and I am very excited to see what Aaron's super secret double feature is this week.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
B be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Indeed. I mentioned Catch Me If You Can. Decided not to go that route. Clearly thought of Howard Hughes stuff like The Aviator. Decided that was a little too on the nose. Even briefly considered I Love You, Philip Morris as an interesting route to go with this, with the deception and stuff. But then I remembered a movie that is way, way too perfect for a double feature for this. It is a Melissa McCarthy movie from a few years back called Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Oh, my God, I saw this.
And basically in this, very, very similar.
Yeah, it is.
Based on a true story, this actually happened. She wasn't getting her stuff published anymore, and so she decided to forge letters from famous people who had died.
Yeah.
So, and sell them on the black market. And it's really good. She's really good in it.
She is.
And it fits perfectly with the themes of this movie and what's going on here. I think this movie handles it a little more seriously. Like, there's a little more, you know, there's a lot of fun in the hoax. Mm-hmm. This movie isn't as fun as The Hoax, but I do find it just as interesting and maybe even a little more contemplative than The Hoax is. So
there's like a odd couple friendship in this movie.
Correct, correct. And she kind of brings him down with her in many ways. So it also really deals with that theme of people just want to believe what they want to believe. In fact, the last shot of the, I guess... spoilers for the last shot of Can You Ever Forgive Me? But the last shot indicates that a person may not care if the letter's forged. They're going to display it anyway. And, you know, and that's kind of the point, right? Is sometimes it's just like, you've given me, you know, fun with this fakery. I'm just going to take this fakery as real. Yeah, it's a really good, really good movie. Really enjoyed it.
Can You Ever Forgive Me is great. I completely forgot about that until you threw up that graphic, and I was like, oh, I've seen that. I think I've seen it twice.
Yeah.
And yeah, she's so much more than her typical comedy style. She's got talent. Anyway, for sure. All right, what is next week's homework for the people?
I've only seen this movie one time and loved it, and I want to go back to it. It is Woody Allen's Match Point.
Oh, my God.
Scarlett Johansson. I am so curious to watch this again with a fresh pair of eyes and see if it holds up as much, because I love this movie. It's in my top 100 movies of all time currently, so I owe it a revisit for
sure. So I've seen this movie probably 7 or 8 times.
Nice.
I really, really like it. I think there's a lot to unpack and discuss. So I'm super excited that you chose it. For those of you playing along at home, this is free on Tubi. It's free on Amazon Prime Video. It's free on Plex. And it's free on the Roku channel. Good job, Aaron, picking something that is free in a lot of places.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
And yes, co-stars Brian Cox and Emily Mortimer. And yes, very, very, very good movie. I'm excited to discuss.
Nice.
All right. I think we have time for one or two questions. And since we didn't get to too many last week.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
Let's try this. Oh, okay. So just to address this, I did have a question for the podcast that was simply, where's Chris been lately? And so I figured I would address again for anybody who missed it.
I love the idea that somebody's just now noticing. I love the idea that somebody's just now being like, hey
it's been 20 episodes. Where's Chris?
Where's that Chris guy?
Chris is on an extended hiatus, a sabbatical, if you will. He has not taken any serious vacations in, since we started CinemaSins. And he needed a break and wanted to pursue some other things. And so he will be back. I appreciate that you guys care enough to notice that he's gone and ask where he is. A proper question, Q&A question. What are some of your favorite underrated or underknown needle drops in movies?
This is a really tough one for me because I only notice needle drops in the moment. They don't stick with me in a way that maybe a quote might. Well, even quotes, I'm not necessarily a quote person either. But so it's like hard for me to recall What I eventually went with was a moment that I did find really impactful, which is the end of Jojo Rabbit, where Bowie's Heroes comes on, and it's in German. It's the German version of Bowie's Heroes. And it's because they're in this moment at the end of the movie, and they just say, well, what do we do now? And they both just start dancing to no music, and then the needle drops. And it's so good. It's just a really good moment. So that's the one that came to mind
for me. That's probably one of my favorite movie endings of all time. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's really great. I like that ending more than I like the whole of the movie. I like the movie. There's a movie from 2000, I think, called Wonder Boys that will eventually get big recommended on this show, unless we did it and I forgot. One of my very favorite movies with Michael Douglas. And there are two original Bob Dylan songs in that movie. One that opens the movie called Things Have Changed. And it's a good song and it won the Oscar. But then the second one is called Not Dark Yet. And it comes about 2/3 of the way through the movie when Michael Douglas's character is kind of at the bottom emotionally. And the song is just great, broody, melancholy Bob Dylan. And every time I watch that movie, I end up going to YouTube and listen to that whole song. Maybe we did do Wonder Boys. People are saying maybe we did. I don't know. I'll have to research. That's the problem when you do 85 episodes of a recommendation show. You start to forget what you've recommended.
It's true.
All right. What is a movie that you like but will not ever make the cut to be featured as a big recommend?
It's so weird to answer this question, because then it's like you're locking yourself into never doing it as a big recommend. So you really, you almost kind of have to be careful. I eventually went with The House Bunny, which I just think is really funny. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about it. I can't imagine a world where I make that a big recommend. So I'm okay locking it in the prison of will never be a big recommend.
My but I do enjoy The House Bunny. That movie.
I don't even know how well it holds up. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I just remember thinking it was hilarious.
Like Emma Stone's in that before she was really famous. I put the 2015 Ed Helms Vacation remake, which just makes me giggle all the way through. And I recognize that that one is a weird funny bone for me because it did not please the masses and it has a bad enough rating. I think I've recommended a couple movies that have bad Rotten Tomatoes scores, but like 13th Warrior, I think. But I have nowhere near the faith in the Vacation movie that I had in the 13th Warrior. All right, one more and then we out of here. I'm going to go get a burger. Which actors who are not related played the most convincing siblings? Bonus points if you also want to do parent-child.
Let's see. I mean, Schwarzenegger and DeVito clearly, played really convincing siblings and twins. They just, the way they look alike and talk alike. That is a joke. Let's see. What about the Winklevoss twins? They're really, really similar in that case, probably because they were played by the same actor. My real answer is the Weasley family in the Harry Potter movies. I think they really look like their siblings. That's a good job of casting that family. So,
all right. Excellent. Excellent. It does not look like we've done a main recommend on Wonder Boys. I'm going to add that to the pile. I think that Jeremy Allen White and John Bernthal in The Bear play convincing siblings. And then there's this little scene movie I enjoy called This Is Where I Leave You that has Jason Bateman, Tina Fey, and Adam Driver all playing siblings. And they don't look like siblings, but behavior-wise, it's so believable. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but
I can't remember.
Like they're siblings. It's got Jane Fonda in it.
I have seen it.
It's another sitting Shiva movie where they're there to bury the father. And,
right.
So that's going to do it for episode 85, Jerry, of Wreckatopia. Next week's homework is Match Point, which is available for free on many platforms, some with ads, some without. We'd like to give a shout out to the chat for being here live and adding comments and helping us know when the static was good or bad and other important information. We really do appreciate you guys. And you give us a feeling of a live audience because you are one. And that keeps us on our toes. We will see you all next week. That's going to do it. Goodbye.
Bye, guys.
a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/CinemaSins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@CinemaSins.com. That's recotopia@CinemaSins.com.
It's me, Dicero. Check one, check two, check three. Speaking of the industry, strike's yes. over for the writers.
I mean, I guess they still have to vote on it.
That's a formality, though, right? I don't know.
I think so.
You would think you put the people up there to do the job, they do the job, and then you vote it through. Like, I mean...
Well, especially since those people are calling this deal exceptional. That's
right.
Quite a word to use. So yeah, I think it's a formality for the most part. I was ultimately surprised that the Directors Guild voted to accept their deal, because mm-hmm. on social media it seemed like a lot of directors were against it, and ultimately mm-hmm. they just didn't vote, or they just didn't go vote. So like 5,000 people voted and it passed, which is kind of surprising to me. But that's a different guild altogether, and that was also 6 months ago, four mm-hmm. months ago.
Yeah. May, so now, right? Yeah, it was May.
So now here's the thing. They can go back to work writing.
Correct.
But the actors are still striking.
Yeah.
And I've seen several writers say, now we go picket and stand with the actors.
Correct.
So are they not going to go to work?
No, they will work. They're just going to take a stand with the writers. I mean, it may come to a place where, you know, they want to make some statement like that. But I think at this point it's dominoes, right? Like, I think the idea is if they're going to give the writers what they want, they'll give the actors what they want, because they're ready, you know.
Well, especially when so many other, like, I think A24 has already given in to both, you know, unions. Demands, if you will. There are several little production houses.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got, what do they call them, waivers or whatever, that even during the strike they were working because they were like, yeah, we'll do that. That's no problem.
Yeah, we'll pay you fairly.
I was doing a lot of thinking yesterday after, you know, thinking about, oh, okay, stuff is going to be back in production. Stuff's going to start coming out again, you know, whenever that may be. I don't think they're going to bring back anything that they pushed to 24 back to 23. I don't think that's happening. I think there's the machine's probably too big to go in reverse like that. But it did get me thinking, like, this doesn't mean the industry is solid. Like, this is an industry in turmoil, whether the writers and actors, you know, get their deals or not. Like, it's just wild what technology has done to the, excuse the word, content industry. You know, like, it's, I have no idea what this looks like 10 years from now. I have no idea.
What really got me thinking that way was when the actors went on strike and the not Fran Drescher guy, who's like the co-in-charge or mm-hmm. second in charge,
right,
was reading off some of what the studios thought was fair and said they want to be able to take background actors and scan their entire bodies.
Right.
And then use that in perpetuity forever with only the one compensation. And I thought, that's wild. And then I started seeing background actors come on Twitter and say,
they did this.
I got scanned 6 months ago. What does that mean for my future? They didn't tell me that's what was happening. So, you know, how much of that cat is already out of the bag?
And how much of it matters? 10 years from now, the people with the money and the power are just going to create human beings to be their actors. Whole cloth. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, like, it's wild to me. They won't need anybody to voice them. They won't need voiceover for them. It'll be just high-tech, realistic animation, so to speak. And the voices will be animated as well through AI or whatever. Like, it's 10 years from now, literally the entire job of acting may be a moot point. How insane is that?
Yeah, I wonder if they can, if a computer can capture what makes human being charismatic.
Not now. You're saying on a philosophical level, you wonder if it's ever possible. Like, if there's some spark there that AI will never be able to replicate.
George Clooney became a star because he's charming as hell, mm-hmm. and he's got a charisma about
right.
the way he carries himself. Can a computer do that? Probably eventually.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I just don't. That's what's wild to me is I have no idea. And like, it really just could be like literally, let's say, you know, you wanted to do an Abels movie. Like, literally you could buy software, say, here's the plot, make me a movie. And you watch it and go, actually, in this act, can we do this? Actually, I want, like, you could be the director of this completely computer generated actual film of your material. Like, it's wild to me, the possibilities in the
somebody
future.
Is going to try and do it, but say it's not. Like, somebody's going to try and
slip it into theaters and be like, gotcha.
Has to be.
No humans somebody were involved there, in this.
You don't work on creating that kind of capability without wanting to fool people.
Right.
That's the ultimate goal, right?
Like a version
they
of
can't
the
tell the difference.
The version of the Turing test, right? Is that what it's called? The Turing test?
Yes. Where,
yeah.
Yes. So if they can't tell the difference between, you know, an AI movie and a you know, human movie, then you have succeeded. You've
right.
reached the pinnacle
right.
of what you can do. So yeah, I would think they would
it's
want
wild.
Almost like a magician's mindset. You want to fool somebody.
And then you get into the ethics and the morals and how do we feel about that? And like so many things, it's going to be, you know, how do we adjust to a society where there just aren't as many jobs needed? Like, people just aren't needed to do as much. And so, you know, when does...
Well, no one's going to go around giving those people money to pay rent and healthcare. It's going to get pretty dystopian.
Well, that is where the turn happens, right? Between utopian and dystopian is if you find a way governmentally or structurally to just have people be able to live comfortably without having to have a job. That's the turn, right? Like, you know,
we already have individual human beings in America who could shave 1% of their wealth and cover the entire nation.
Right.
And they aren't doing it.
No,
they're not. They would never miss that. That would be like a dime to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They just want more.
Yep.
So unless we get somebody to that level of wealth is altruistic, which I believe is impossible.
I think seen in my life the idea that laws or, you know, general community ethics flow uphill. In other words, like eventually, like we think like president, Congress, those, like we think that's where, you know, ethics comes from, or morals come from, or laws come from, or whatever. But it's actually the opposite way around. It's actually over time, what the community wants flows uphill. For instance, the legalization of marijuana is a big one. That's becoming legal in more and more states just because the people want it. Like, the community wants it. The conversations are being had of like, how is you know, marijuana somehow worse than alcohol? You know what I mean? Like, those are the conversations that people are having. And so eventually it's just, you know, it's going to be that way, but it just takes a long time.
Not because the community is talking about it and the people with money are like, you've won me over. It's because the people in the community are talking about it and the people with money are like, I can make money off of that.
Yes, sure. In a capitalistic society.
We have not changed any hearts with our community campaign to get weed legal. We haven't.
I think hearts have been changed. I think hearts on the ground have been changed. You don't?
Well, yes.
Oh, okay.
Again, I'm talking about the people who are in a position to make universal changes or changes that impact the entire nation are currently the people with money.
Yes, because we live in an extremely capitalistic society. Yes.
Right. So I don't see how
that changes.
A whole podcast episode on this.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.